I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. For 20 years now, writer-producer Tom Fontana has made some of the best television series on television. He got his start on St. Elsewhere, working under the late Bruce Paltrow. He worked with Barry Levinson on Homicide: Life on the Street, then went from NBC to HBO to create Oz, a series about life in prison that ended earlier this year. Oz was the first Fontana series to be released on DVD. Next week, Homicide, 10 years after its debut, also gets the home video treatment, with a four-disc set from A&E Home Video covering the show's first two seasons. Homicide's very talented cast includes Andre Brower, Ned Beatty, Richard Belzer, Kyle Secor, and Yaphet Kotto. They play Baltimore detectives whose successes and failures are written up in plain view on the precinct's big board. Solved cases in black ink, unsolved cases in red. The unsolved cases, for these persistent characters, are hard to let go of, even very old cases. Here's Clark Johnson as Meldrick, talking to his partner Crosetti, played by John Polito. They're sitting in a hospital room, killing time while waiting for a patient, who's also a suspect, to wake up.
You look pitiful, man. You all right?
I couldn't sleep last night. My mind was racing all night long. Even when I was sleeping, I was dreaming about it.
What?
There were two people in the box with Lincoln the night he was shot. It was John Wilkes Booth, and there was a Major Henry Rathbone. Now, how come we don't hear about this Henry Rathbone?
So you think Major Henry Rathbone's the guy that capped Lincoln, huh?
I don't know. It just doesn't hang together.
Hey, man, Booth jumped down on the stage, broke his leg trying to get away.
When the president was shot, what the hell would you do?
This is what kept you up on it.
Who was the doctor who set John Wilkes Booth's leg? It was Dr. Samuel Mudd, okay? 100 years later, who gets passed over for Anchorman? Roger Mudd. It's his great-great-grandson. What was I tell you about the power structure in this country?
Excuse me. I didn't notice. Was Abraham Lincoln on the board this morning?
Meldrick, all our lives since we're kids, we were taught in the history book that John Wilkes Booth shot Lincoln. Now, if that's not true, maybe nothing's true.
Tom Fontana, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. Good to be back.
What's fun for you about Homicide in particular in terms of the DVD? I know that even the packaging, you know, trumpets the fact that see them in the actual order in which the producers intended for the first time.
Yes,
which has got to be a dig at NBC.
Yeah, totally. When I saw that, I loved that because we were always fighting with NBC because we would, you know, we would plot these episodes very carefully, A leading to B, leading to C, leading to D. And they would see an episode and they go, oh, we're going to put this one in sweeps. And you go, well, if you put that one in sweeps. I mean, the classic example is the death of
Crosetti,
because he had been dead 2 weeks before the episode where he died aired. So people were like, what are they talking about? Crosetti's dead? Like, if I missed something? It was just, it was incredibly frustrating for us. You know, and it's not like what was great about Homicide was it wasn't like if they showed one over the other, suddenly our numbers would spike. You know what I mean? The people who were going to watch the show were the people who were going to watch the show. It wasn't like suddenly they're going to go, oh, you know, some guy who would rather be watching Nash Bridges is not suddenly going to go, hey, whoa, I saw that one where the guy dies. We got to go and we got to watch that show this week, you know. So I never understood the network's penchant for flipping our episodes around.
Now,
and you'd think we would have learned over the course of the seasons to stop doing it the way we were doing it so we wouldn't get screwed, but we didn't.
I'd like to ask you some questions after 20 years of doing television, after St. Elsewhere, after Oz, after Homicide, what you've learned that you're passing on to younger writers or what you think of just the state of television right now. I mean, what do you think of reality shows? What do you think of cable versus network? That sort of stuff.
Well, the first thing, I think it's potentially the most exciting time to be a young writer, a young director, a young actor in television, maybe even a young producer, because there are so many outlets to try things where, you know, back in the day, there were three networks, and if you couldn't get on one of those three networks, you were out of the game. Now there's so many places to go and try things, and cable and you know all the variations and all the kind of specific kind of channels that exist. So I think it's a very exciting time. The reality television thing I'm not so afraid of because, not because I think, oh, it's going to burn itself out. I think it will. But because I keep coming down to the side that you don't cry at the end of a reality television show. You will cry at the end of an episode of NYPD Blue. We do something. People who write dramas and comedies do something different and serve a different need than reality television shows. So I say, you know, bring it all on. Dramas have survived the game shows and westerns and you know, the rise of the comedy series after Bill Cosby. News magazines. There was a time when news magazines, you couldn't get away from a news magazine.
Not
too
long
ago, yeah.
Now
they've kind of petered out. Yeah. So I'm a big believer in the survival of drama. I don't think we're going anywhere. And I think, you know, shows like Boomtown, Kingpin, you know, The Wire, all those shows that came up last year are just another example of how strong the next generation of television writers are.
In the first batch of Homicide episodes, it led up to an episode that you wrote called Three Men and a Dino, which I still think is one of the best things I've ever seen
on
television. And it is basically Kyle Secor and Andre Brower and guest star Moses Gunn, who is the suspect in a murder of a young girl, in an interrogation room for an hour. And the rhythms of these actors is so amazing through this hour. And I'd like to play a piece of it. It comes about halfway through. They have to interrogate this guy and get a confession out of him within 12 hours, or they have to cut him loose. And this is well into the night. And it is a sequence in which they are just speeding up their pace of everything, trying to shake this guy.
You want to know what the polygraph test says?
Hmm?
You're lying. You're a liar. You even tried to hold your breath to cover up. But you know what blew it off the charts?
Hmm?
Off the screen? Look here. Your heart. Your heart just blew those needles right off the screen. Man, I'm acting get whiplash looking at your test. And this guy says it's the highest he's ever seen, and this guy is an expert.
Your heart of all things. That's perfect for you, Risley. Don't you see? Your heart, because your heart doesn't want to lie.
Let me see that.
No. This is police property. This is evidence for your trial.
I know enough about the law to know you can't use that in court.
Listen to Mr. Legal Beagle here. He knows all about the law.
Is that because you watched the court channel?
I didn't lie.
Well, then how come you failed the test?
I don't know.
That's your answer for everything.
It's not going to work now.
If you weren't lying, why'd you fail the test?
I was nervous.
Why were you nervous?
I feel guilty.
You feel guilty because you did it?
No. Because you made me feel guilty.
No, you failed this test because you are guilty.
If I was guilty and knew it, then why would I take the test?
You tell us.
No, I know why. I'll tell you why.
Because you know we got you. You know it's over, Risley.
Mm-hmm. You're going to jail.
You're
going to
do time.
That's right.
Tim, look at his eyes.
What's wrong with my eyes?
Tears coming out of your eyes.
There ain't no tears coming from my eyes.
His eyes are brimming with tears.
Ready to burst.
It's going
to
get a lot worse.
A lot worse.
It never gets any better. You'll
probably go back.
Back to being a drunk.
No, I ain't never gonna do that.
And you wind up killing yourself.
If you're lucky.
I didn't kill her.
Why you put your head down?
Because I'm tired of saying it.
You're tired of saying it because it's not true.
Be a man for once. Own up to it.
I would. Anybody else would, too.
Be a man for once.
Why don't you want to tell me, Risley?
Huh?
Why don't you want to tell me?
Huh?
Why?
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 Huh? All right, don't say it.
Don't say it, Risley.
All right?
Don't say it.
All right, that was a scene from Three Men and a Dino from Homicide. With Kyle Secor, Andre Brower, and Moses Gunn. How much of that was on set with the actors and the director, and how much of that was on the page in terms of the speed?
Well, the from a dialogue point of view, everything was in the script. From a rhythm point of view, that was something that was developed by the actors and the director, Martin Campbell, in a very, very, very short amount of rehearsal time. Though the thing you have to remember is that I only had the courage to write that episode based on the fact that I had seen what these two guys could do, the two actors could do, in the pilot episode, in the very first episode. So it wasn't like, because I'm a kind of writer that once I get an actor's voice in my head,
mm-hmm.
It's much easier to write for them, and I have to say, Martin Campbell when he was directing it, he spent about 3 days before we started shooting that episode in the box, living in that room and looking at it from every single angle. And what he did as a director, which is extraordinary, is he never shot after a certain sequence of, like, say, let's say 5 or 10 pages, he never shot from that angle again. So the entire hour keeps changing the point of view of the camera so that you never get tired of being in that room. So it was really that episode, obviously I'm very proud of, because the people who worked on it really gave it everything they had and were incredibly inventive with something that could have been a pretty dull hour of television if they hadn't cared so much.
I don't know if you've thought this far ahead with DVD problems, but what happens when you get to a Homicide season where a story began on Homicide and ended on Law and Order?
Well, actually, it went the opposite way. All the crossover shows that we did all started on Wednesdays and ended on Fridays because I kept saying to Dick, well, I need the big number. You already get the big number, so you have to give me the concluding episode.
Uh-huh.
But having said that, what we did very carefully was to make – he made his episode self-contained and we made our episode self-contained so that you could enjoy our episode if you didn't see the Law and Order and vice versa. So I don't think anybody seeing those episodes on DVD are going to suddenly go – what was that about? Because we really laid down the information for the audience.
You know, I must say those crossovers always struck me as so strange. They were entertaining, but it's like Dick Wolf's whole idea with Law and Order is you don't want to know these guys outside of work, and on Homicide is like you don't even really want to know the work. That's all you want to know is the guys outside.
That's true.
So
it was funny. Jerry Orbach, God love Jerry, he comes to Baltimore, and we had that scene in the first crossover where he and Belzer are talking in the bar, and they're talking about how Belzer realizes that Orbach's character has slept with his ex-wife. And at this scene, when the director called cut, Orbach comes over and he goes, wow, I actually had sex. My character had sex. He was like, you know, the most exciting thing I get to say on Law and Order is, what color was the car, ma'am? You know, he said, now I'm actually talking about my sex life. And we had him playing pool, which, of course, knowing Jerry a long time, I knew he was a brilliant pool player, so that we didn't even have to do the fake, you know, okay, now let's cut away to the cue, you know,
right.
And, you know, get the expert in to make the actual shot. Jerry knows all that stuff, so he's a fabulous pool player. And it was so much fun having them come down, Ben Brad and all of them. And, oh, I don't know if you know this story, but Jill Hennessy, it was worse for the Law & Order people than it was for us because we had so many characters. We could write somebody low in an episode and send them up to New York to be on Law & Order with them because they basically have, you know, 3 people in one section, 3 people in the other section. It was harder for them to send them down to Baltimore for us. And Jill Hennessy was needed. We needed her down in Baltimore to shoot a substantial scene. They needed her in New York to sit in the courtroom while Sam Waterston made one of his summations. So we were all like, well, what are we going to do? And, you know, the thing. And they really needed her there because the character had been involved in the story and it would have seemed weird if she suddenly wasn't there. And it turns out Jill has a twin. So,
oh, no kidding.
I swear to God. So the only time in the history of Law & Order, Jill Hennessy's sister played her character. She had no dialogue. She just sat in the chair. And meantime, Jill was down in Baltimore working with us. So,
okay. I have to admit, I still think about some of your characters. And I always wanted Bayless from Homicide to be like thrown into prison in Oz just to keep that going, even though I know it couldn't work. Do you ever not let go of your characters or think about them from time to time and think about where you might have taken them next or where they might be?
Well, I will say this, that I think about them for many, many years after I stop writing the show. But then that becomes, it becomes almost like a death in the sense of that you then put that character in a place where you think of it fondly, but it's not haunting you the way it once did. But to this day, I'll be, you know, reading the paper and I'll see something about medicine and I'll go, wow, this will make a great episode of St. Elsewhere. And then I have to go, oh, no, wait, we don't do that anymore. You know, and being somebody who doesn't want to repeat myself and doesn't want to do, you know, Homicide, The Next Generation or Son of Oz or any of that stuff, it's harder because you those muscles get so primed, and then I'm consciously letting those muscles get soft to get to try to build up other writing muscles. So it's a little bit frustrating, but you know, when a great actor really fills a character out, they don't go away that easy.
When you got pulled into television, you were writing for the stage. And I assume at that time, or I presume that you wanted to have a career as a playwright.
Yes.
Do you still? Do you think about going back and writing something for the stage now?
Well, it seems that over the course of time, first of all, I was not a very good playwright. And I was not a very successfully produced playwright. But over the course of time, the theater has discovered that I write something much better than a play, and that's a check. So the theater seems to be very happy that I'm not writing plays and that I am writing checks. Having said that, what's interesting, too, for me about where my head has gone as a writer is I thought of myself as a playwright, and over the last 20 years, I've started to think of myself as just a writer, in this, not just a writer, but you know what I mean? As a writer in the broader sense of the term. I would like to write another play. I don't know. I don't want to clutter the theater up with another bad play. So unless I come up with a really good and compelling play to write, I don't think I will. But I would like to, if I could. I'd like to write a book. I'd like to write an epic poem. I'd like, you know, I would like to keep challenging myself as a writer, not just in the television stuff that I do, but in the but in all the writing that I do.
I have a couple questions about your method of writing. I know that you write in the morning just about every morning. Do you play music when you write?
No. Actually, I get up at 5:30 every single morning, and I write. It's usually dark, and I like to say that that's when New York takes its little breath, one of the few times that New York takes a breath at 5:30 in the morning. And in that breath is when I try to really kind of focus in on the work. So it becomes, it's very solitary. There's no distractions. I don't, I go from my bed to my desk and I start writing. I have very, very little ritual connected to it other than the stumbling in the dark to try to find the light. because I think the more awake you are at the beginning, the harder it is to start.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it has to be seamless, coming out of sleep and going right into the unconsciousness of writing.
Do you dream about what you're going to be writing the next day or plan to write the next day?
I do. I'll give you the short version of my quote-unquote process, which is that before I go to bed, I review the first thing I'm going to write in the morning, the first scene and what the point is and what the purpose of and who the characters are. And I don't do a lot of time. I just think about it for a little bit. And then I go to sleep. And as I'm coming out of sleep, I am actually the last dream I have of the morning, in the morning, is the scene that I'm going to be writing, that first scene that I'm going to be writing. Now, it doesn't happen 100% of the time, but it happens the majority of the time. And what it does is it just it makes going from sleep to writing almost seamless, if you will, because my mind is already – there are times when I literally have to – when I sit up in bed because I have to get out of bed to write because of what I've just had in my head in the dream.
Did you ever have a dream and you woke up and you thought, this is going to be the best hour of television ever, and by the time you wake up or have a cup of coffee and start actually putting it down, you realize it's like one of those awful, dumb dreams that don't make any sense at all?
Well, yeah. I mean, I used to keep a pad by my bed and thinking that, oh, this will be great. I'll write down if I, in the middle of the night, I get an idea. And one night I got up, I woke up and I had this dream where I had everything worked out, and it was amazing. And I wrote down, scribbled down, went back to sleep, got up the next morning excited, and all it said was boy meets girl. So I thought I had gotten every nuance, every scene down. I mean, I thought I'd been writing for like an hour. I wrote three words.
Well, I wouldn't throw away your dream, because I think in those three big series of yours, I don't think you've done boy meets girl yet. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Oh, thank you.
Tom Fontana, whose Homicide: Life on the Street is about to be released on DVD. Fontana is also creator of Oz and a writer-producer on Sane Elsewhere.